Hello, my name is Dan Brown, and today, again, I'm doing another A Lens a Day, conversations about information architecture, and today I get to talk to the astounding Francis Rowland. Francis, thank you so much for joining me.
Hello, sir. Nice to see you again.
It's nice to see you. I mean, last time we saw each other was probably in person in the UK when I was there for UX Brighton, UX.
I think the last time I saw you was in Stockholm for EuroIA.
That's right. That makes more sense.
I think that was it.
This is like a EuroIA reunion. I feel like I've talked to a bunch of people who I last saw at EuroIA. So
it's that kind of conference, right?
It's that kind of conference, and this is that kind of podcast or experiment or whatever it is that we're doing here. So thanks for joining me. I'm talking to folks about information architecture and specifically process, because I feel like that's one of those things that we don't get to talk, tease out a lot of, like the nuts and bolts of how we do this stuff. I've been asking folks a lot about how they collaborate with other people, but maybe I'll take a different angle now. What does it look like when you've spoken to a bunch of folks, you've engaged with them to kind of get their input and understanding, and you need to just sit and do some deep thinking about IA? Do you give yourself time to do that? And what does that time look like? Do you mind sharing that with us?
Not at all, yeah. I think we're lucky that sometimes in projects, you know, with my teammates and I, we do get time to be able to kind of go away and work with things that we've learned and work with the sort of the material, the information that matters to people, and try and begin to arrange it in different ways. And so I guess, you know, we might, well, these days we'd probably do it using everyone's favorite online whiteboards or something. In the past, we might have stuck things on the wall, but just begin to kind of throw things up there and begin to try and restructure things based on what we've learned, based on, you know, what do people need? What frustrations do they face? What would they like to be able to do? Those kinds of things. And begin to try things out and see what begins to hang together and what might work. Sometimes we'll move that sort of thing into good old spreadsheets and just begin to, you know, when things are taking a little bit more shape, maybe make them a little bit more structured and a little bit, not rigid exactly, but kind of slightly more formal, I guess, to begin to be able to have conversations with people. That can be very useful time then to talk with our technical colleagues, I guess, about, you know, how could we build this? Will this make sense? Can we get from this bit to this bit? But yeah, I think kind of taking time apart, I guess, to kind of just do that, often in a pair, I would say. Often it's not a kind of a solo exercise, at least in a pair, if not maybe two or three people, to just kind of work with things and thrash out ideas. What did we understand? What matters, and how might we approach something?
That was awesome. I sometimes worry that when, like, push comes to shove and someone asks me to describe my job, I will say I spend time sitting and staring at a wall full of post-it notes, not even moving them around, just staring at them, right? Trying to see something there, trying to see some connections there. It's really interesting to me that I asked you about sort of what is your sort of heads down time look like? And you said that even when you're sort of doing some deep thinking, that happens in pairs. Do you think that there's this kind of work requires more than one person engaged all the time?
All the time, maybe not. I think there's probably value, I think, for many people to have individual time to just kind of, let me just go away, percolate over things that I've learned, just let me think through things. And I think that's great. And it's good to be able to recognize that with colleagues or with clients that we're working with, just to kind of give people space. For me personally, though, I like to be able to kind of bounce ideas around with somebody and just kind of check rationale and just check. I think particularly because, you know, you don't want to kind of go off down some avenue that seems very sensible, but there's like a little thing that you just haven't stopped to ask yourself. Somebody else might kind of go, what about such and such and think, ah, oh, yeah, yeah. So I think that's very valuable. And it's great to have colleagues you can do that with. So yeah, a mixture maybe, but
yeah,
I like talking to people.
What? I mean, I find instantaneously, the moment I start saying an idea out loud, it looks different to me. Like it just appears different. And it is a strange experience where you're sort of sitting in your own head, looking at something and it makes sense. And then just by uttering it out loud to another person, it looks and feels and seems like a different thing. Like you're looking at it in a new way, even though the person hasn't actually said anything, you're just saying it out loud. To me, I find that happens to me more than I care to admit. Can you maybe give us an example of a recent project where you were hashing out something? Maybe give us a sense of what it is you were hashing out and what that process looked like.
Yeah, so I think with teammates, we've done a couple of projects recently. We've worked on kind of, I guess, you know, people call them different things, but kind of digital workplace, intranet kind of projects in the last couple of years. But for quite big organizations where the workforce might be quite diverse and they might be distributed as well. And so you need to kind of have spent a bit of time understanding, well, who are people and what kind of information do they need in, you know, is there priority to that? Are there, you know, different needs across the organization, all of that kind of thing. And having taken that, for example, working with, there's an organization in the UK that is kind of, I think, part of UK government essentially, or connected to UK government, and they're responsible for representing children and young people in the court system, so in adoption cases or fostering cases. And we worked with them for a year and a bit to help rebuild this kind of digital workplace, and my teammate Elizabeth and I worked a lot on the IA for that, and really trying to kind of see it through lenses based on research that we've been involved in as well, and really begin to kind of challenge ourselves and sometimes challenge the organization about what, you know, which things mattered most, where which things should have more prominence and more priority. Maybe sometimes how, you know, what do you call things, what you call something at the moment versus what might make more sense to people. And I think a lot of that was done through conversation of kind of analysis after research, and we knew that the next thing we were going to work on was the IA. So we would be asking ourselves, well, we've heard certain things, what does it mean for us? What does it mean for the next thing we have to do? And then we did, in that case, I think we did work quite a lot in the spreadsheet, and we probably had three or four versions of how things could be structured. And Elizabeth began to work on a kind of light taxonomy that the organization could begin to use to help tag things and connect them together. And all of that took a lot of back and forth, working with the client as well, kind of saying, look, here's where we're at the moment. You know, here's why we're thinking in a certain way. What do you make of it? And I think that worked well because it you know, it wasn't just like, we know how to do it in one go. It was quite iterative. It was collaborative as well between us and with the client. And yeah, then you get to something that hopefully makes sense to people. Well, apparently it does make sense. It seems to have been successful. So that's
great. That's great. What a good story too. And I really like that you didn't come up with just one idea for how to categorize things. I think that's one of the misconceptions of information architecture, is that when we sort of think about categorization schemes, we start with one idea, or sort of as we're doing kind of a bottom-up approach, we're just sort of imagining one concept. And my process always entails coming up with three or four or five or six different ways of categorizing stuff. And it's not always that those are equally good ways, but they just allow us to kind of explore the space differently as well. Do you recall what was the sort of deciding factor in these three or four different ways that you and Elizabeth came up with these approaches for structuring the information, categorizing the information? What sort of tipped the scales in one direction or another? Do you remember what criteria you used?
I think a lot of it was understanding problems that people faced previously with the kind of existing system, the kind of, you know, well, it was an intranet and lots of other bits and pieces kind of hanging off it. I'm sure you've seen similar projects, you know, this kind of a labyrinth of different systems. So having understood the problems, I think, you know, where we headed to, which probably isn't unusual, you know, it's a kind of a common approach to arranging and structuring things, was much more task focused. So having spent time to understand, well, what do people do? What do they really need to do now? Where, you know, when do they need to get information? And sometimes with this organization we worked with, it does need to be like, I need it now because I'm going into court and I need to have the right piece of guidance, for example. So I think it was realizing that a certain way of structuring it would really make a difference to people, help to kind of nudge in that direction, and gives you the kind of rationale for saying, we think this would be a sensible way to structure a certain part of the information that you're presenting to people.
Yeah, that's great. It occurs to me that when we tasking, you know, or thinking about people's tasks are like a really nice, straightforward heuristic for, okay, what's one way we can categorize this stuff? Let's just take a task-based approach. It's one of those things that I always throw in when I'm exploring different ways of categorizing stuff, even if it's not appropriate. It's a helpful reminder for, like, we're serving people's needs here. One of the interesting challenges with that, really with any means for categorizing, is how tasks, the priority for people's tasks might change over time. And this was my clumsy transition to talking about the lens. So maybe you can share with us the lens that we picked for you, and maybe describe it in your own words, or maybe just give us a sense of sort of what it means to you. Would that be okay?
Absolutely, yeah, sure. So we could talk about seasonality. That's the lens. So the idea that the structure, the prominence that we give to certain pieces of information might change in different seasons, or due to, you know, changes throughout a year, as needs change, as things that an organization is involved in might change as well, so that they need to kind of shift what they do and how their information is arranged and presented to people.
Is this something that you've seen kind of in your own work? Is this a lens that you've needed to apply to something that you've worked on?
Yeah, I think the example that occurred to me really is, I've been very lucky to be able to work with a charity called Mind here in the UK, along with several of my teammates. Mind are the UK's biggest mental health charity, and their kind of mission really is to provide very clear, very accurate information to people about mental health conditions, about medication, about their rights, etc., as well as engaging people in fundraising and campaigns and inviting donations and that kind of thing. And Mind are very alive, very astute about the fact that you know, mental health is a very diverse topic, of course, and people have very different experiences all the time, but there can be things that can be quite seasonal about it that can affect people, and can kind of prompt perhaps kind of negative emotions, for example. So Mind will sometimes run campaigns or promote information on, particularly on their website, that is essentially seasonal. Sometimes it might be actually seasonal, like around the Christmas season, you know, when many people might feel very lonely, and that might kind of lead them into negative areas of their mental health. But there could be other things that the organization knows it needs to campaign about, related to, I don't know, maybe some aspect of government policy that's been in the news. So they're very able to kind of react to that, and yeah, I think kind of help to guide people towards certain collections of information or advice or other routes to help that they need, which is hugely valuable. But yeah, they need to be able to react, basically.
It, I mean, the lens is called seasonality, but it's really about time just in general, right? This idea that users' needs are not static, that a business's objectives, you know, maybe they're static, but the methods and the strategies that they use to meet those objectives are not static. And this idea that if we think of a structure as a static thing, then it is already failed, right? Then we've already created something that can't flex or adapt or be aware of its context, of it, you know, the structure that we're designing, a virtual structure that we're designing, lives inside a product or inside a website, which lives inside a business, which meets the needs of customers. And all of those things are not static objects. That in a sense, the intent of the structure itself needs to be, in a sense, aware of the fact that everything around it is changing over time. And that can be hard to build into a structure.
I agree. I mean, definitely there's, you can see that these sorts of things need to be flexible and need to be able to adapt. As you say, I mean, the kind of broadly the design work that we get involved in will often, you know, while we advocate for users or customers or patients or whoever it might be, we're also balancing the kind of strategic needs of a client, of a business or a charity or something. And their objectives might change as well. So all of the things can be moving all the time in reality, and people know that. So yeah, absolutely, we need to be happy, be ready to kind of say, well, this isn't quite working. We need to kind of go in and change that. And certainly working with Mind, we've done that sometimes where there's particular, it may be areas of a website, but it might be more like kind of thematically related pieces of content that need to kind of be brought together or moved apart again, depending on something that we've recognized. And we kind of go in and do some work together to do something with that, I guess. Absolutely, though, not static. It's kind of, you know, moving with what needs to be done.
Right. I wonder if you could talk to me a little bit about how you might help a designer who's new to information architecture think about this lens, or really information architecture in general. My experience has been that there's a lot less attention being paid to IA by user experience designers who are relatively new to the field, and so I feel almost an obligation to coach them, right? To advise them, to mentor them on how to bring IA thinking to bear on their work. What, I don't know if you have found this in the consultancy you work for, or if you've found this in your experience, but I'm curious, how might you advise or mentor a newer designer in applying this lens, or really just applying any kind of IA thinking to their work?
Sure. Yeah, it's a kind of a quite a big, multifaceted question, that, really, in a way. I think I've heard some of the other people you've had conversations with address some of this as well a little bit, that you know, once you get into information architecture, the it's the material that you're often dealing with, and you need to know how it's going to be connected and how it's going to be shaped and kind of presented to people through different media. So I think working with people who are maybe newer to user experience design, I guess it would be to kind of remind them or to help them recognize that when they're considering a user's experience of something and trying to kind of craft things in a certain way, often that thing that they're crafting is going to be going to have a kind of within it all the information, that kind of often the content that needs to be delivered to people. And so inevitably their work is going to start to touch that. And so, you know, we'll often encourage UX designers to be curious and to want to explore and want to understand people, which is absolutely right. And I think that is often a kind of a common characteristic that, that people have in this broad field. But then you could, I think I would encourage people to apply that curiosity to what is it we're working with here? What ultimately are people trying to get to or interact with, which is often the actual information. And then, well, actually, how is that structured? How does it fit together? Does that make sense? Is that well designed? And I think, you know, that can be, well, if I think back to when I kind of started working on it, that can be really exciting because it sort of opens up. Oh, it's not just like, you know, it's not just the superficial, the surface level. There's all of this other stuff that you can begin to kind of get involved with and try and affect and help to craft that user experience that you hope to achieve for people.
Francis, that was awesome. I think we will leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for asking me. It was great to be here and to see you again.